12th. It's our class in Stories of Men and Women in the Talmud, and this is class 9. I called it Marriage, Principled Separation, and Reunification. Just notice now the connection between last week's class and this week's class. Last week, when we talked about the miracle of Hanukkah from a feminist perspective, from the perspective of Judith, the one version of the story that we saw centered on the rites of the first night, that the Greek ruler has the right to ravage the bride before she enters the chuppah and marries her husband. And according to the version of the Midrash that we looked at, there are many versions, because of this decree of the Greeks, the Jews were not getting married. Men and women were not coming together in holy matrimony until it became time for the daughter of the Maccabees to get married, and they arranged the marriage, and she was up in arms. Judith was up in arms about what's going to happen to her the night before her wedding. So she brings her brothers to revolt. She inspires them to revolt, according to, again, one version. And they revolt, and they're victorious, and everyone lives happy life after, which means, from the point of view of that story, that now men and women, bride and groom, can marry again. So that perspective on the Hanukkah story was about separation of men and women, couldn't get married, and then as a result of the efforts of a woman, men and women can again get married. That theme is the one we're picking up this week, not related to Hanukkah. I don't have any more sources. I tried to save paper. Sorry. So we're going to begin by reading from this beautiful story. We're going to read two stories today. The first beautiful story is from Midrash Rabbah and the Song of Songs. And the way we should begin is by looking at the verse in the Song of Songs that this Midrash is based upon. So open up to the Tanakh, to the Song of Songs. It's quite near the end of the Hebrew scripture. Let's see, can I help you find it? I'm going to have problems myself finding it. The Song of Songs is with the other scrolls, like Ecclesiastes and Ruth and Esther. In the English only, the JPS, we're looking at page 1405. 1,405 in the English only. In the Hebrew English, it's page
1,727. Hebrew and English, 1,727.
Yeah.
I don't have that book, so I'm going to have to figure it out.
Uh-huh.
So it comes in after Job.
After Job, which comes after Proverbs, which comes after Psalms. Reading from the beginning of the book of the Song of Songs. The Song of Songs by Solomon. Oh, give me of the kisses of your mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Your ointments yield a sweet fragrance. Your name is like finest oil, therefore do maidens love you. Draw me after you, let us run. The king has brought me to his chambers. Let us delight and rejoice in your love, savoring it more than wine. Like new wine, they love you. Clearly, it's a love song between a man and a woman. And the verse that we're going to look at is verse 4, where it said, let us delight and rejoice in your love. So it's a celebration of love between man and woman. And the Midrash builds on that verse. So we're going now to the Midrash that I printed. It, of course, is a slightly different translation. We will be glad and rejoice in thee. And the thee seems to be, of course, the man. The woman is talking about rejoicing in the man, in her spouse, in her groom. We have learnt elsewhere. So the Midrash is quoting from a source that appears in the Babylonian Talmud in Tractate Yevamot. If a man has married a wife and lived with her 10 years, and she has not borne him a child, he is not at liberty to neglect the duty of begetting children. At the beginning of the book of Genesis, it says, be fruitful and multiply. And that's counted as one of the 613 mitzvot. And for reasons that I'm certainly not going to go into now, it's understood that the mitzvah is incumbent upon men and not upon women. Mm-hmm. In a technical halachic sense, a woman is not violating any mitzvah if she doesn't have children. But a man is violating a mitzvah if he doesn't have children. A boy and a girl is the halacha. Of course, there are cases in which it's you try as hard as you can, and you can't. You can't get married, you can't have children, whatever. It's there's duress. But in a technical sense, on the surface of things, there's a mitzvah to have children. What happens if a couple gets married and they don't have children? They try to have children. They go to doctors, they go to witch doctors, they go to rabbis, they go to wherever they go. They go to acupuncture, it doesn't work. They can't have children. So the halacha says in Tractate Yevamot that the man and woman are supposed to divorce after 10 years. Mm. The assumption is, and I understand this is a pre-modern assumption, that if there's no children, it's the biological fault of the woman. They didn't know so much about male infertility. The assumption is that there's a certainty, or at least a chance, that it's the woman's issue, so he, the man who has the mitzvah, should have another wife. Divorce the first one, and get married to someone else, and try to fulfill the mitzvah.
Why not have two wives?
That's a good question. That's a possibility also.
I mean, in that time frame, men did have more than one wife.
It was certainly allowed.
Why would they have to divorce the first wife, just if they loved her and didn't have children? Why couldn't they take another wife and still have the first wife? I mean, why would the halacha encourage divorce?
Yeah, so very good stuff that Dorothy just said. Let me work on two points that she made. One, why not just take a second wife? The answer is probably, although I'm not certain, probably because although it was technically permitted for a man to have a second wife, in many times of Jewish history and in many cultures, it was permitted but not considered acceptable. It was just not done. It's true that only in the 10th century did the Ashkenazi world formally outlaw polygamy, but for hundreds of years before that, in certain cultures of Jews, it was just not done. That's point number one. Point number two, Dorothy pointed out that this halakha that mandates divorce after 10 years flies in the face, is in tension with the whole idea of love between man and wife. How could the halakha say divorce someone who you really love and get the greatest degree of spiritual and emotional fulfillment from just in order to fulfill one mitzvah of pru uvu, of having children? That's the central issue of the story we're going to read, Dorothy. You put your finger exactly on the issue. So here we go. Let me just say one other thing, which is that issue, the tension between love and procreation, which is going to be the centerpiece of our story, is actually already latent in what we read. Because the halakha says divorce because there's no children, but what verse are we explicating from the Song of Songs? The verse that says, be glad and rejoice together, man and woman. The whole context of the Song of Songs is erotic love between man and woman. So we have already that tension between the theme of Song of Songs and the dry, technical mandate of the halakha that says divorce if there's no children. Now the story. Rav Edi said, it happened once that a woman in Sidon, which we know today is on the coast in Lebanon, had lived 10 years with her husband without bearing him a child. They came to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, which means it's the second century of the Common Era, and requested to be divorced from one another. He said to them, I adjure you, just as you got married with feasting and drinking, so you shall separate with feasting and drinking. They took his advice and kept holiday and made a great feast, and she got him too drunk. When his sensibilities returned to him, he said to her, my daughter, pick out any article you want in the house and take it with you to your father's house. That's where she's going to live, in her father's house, of course.
What if the father doesn't want her back?
Let's go on. After I read the story. What did she do? When he was asleep, she gave an order to her servants and handmaids to lift him up on the bed and take and carry him to her father's house. At midnight, he awoke from his sleep. And when the effects of the wine passed from him, he said, "My daughter, where am I?" She replied, "You are in my father's house." "And what am I doing in your father's house?" he asked. She replied, "Did you not say to me last night, 'Take any article you like from my house and go to your father's house'? There is nothing in the world I care for more than you." They again went to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and he went and prayed for them, and they were remembered, meaning that they had a child. Cute story. But there's a lot to it. There's a lot of levels here. So, in this society, there's no such thing as a woman who lives alone. She either lives with her father or lives with her husband. It's very rare for a woman to live on her own. I understand her father might be passed away. I don't know what happens in those cases, but the standard scenario is that in divorce and in widowhood, the woman goes back to live with her biological family. So now, to go back through the story and try and understand what's happening between the lines. About to say something, Barbara? No.
I was just thinking, at the time that this was taking place, and there was a marriage ceremony, there were vows. So in the books of Moses that bind you, so you would be breaking one vow, in a sense, to God, maybe, in order to fulfill another mitzvah?
There's no vow never to get divorced. There's no vow that says we will live together forever.
It says not, for better or worse. And worse is not having children.
Not in the ketubah that I know about.
Not in, but
I mean, if you really want to get technical,
yeah.
When you do the marriage vow, you promise to live through good and bad times.
But
together.
Not in Judaism.
Yeah, not in Hebrew. Not that the ketubah doesn't say that.
All you do is that you marry and you agree to live together. The man takes upon himself certain obligations. The woman takes upon herself certain obligations. But it never says you'll not get divorced. And the Torah provides for divorce. There's indeed a disagreement in the Talmud. What are grounds for divorce? And they're pretty liberal. Judaism is not against divorce at all. Not at all. I'm not saying it's the best thing in the world.
In contemporary times now, if you wanted to get a get, this would hold true, not being able to conceive?
That is a very big question. It's discussed in sources.
Doesn't the husband have to agree, though?
Yes.
In any case?
Yes, but that's not the question. Right. So the question is, so today, a couple is allowed to divorce if they haven't had children, but they don't have to. But the source we're reading, the source from Tractate Yevamot that was quoted, it says he's not at liberty to neglect the duty. It looks like it's saying that they have to get divorced. Like they have to get divorced. Again, it's not done today. Today they're allowed. They don't have to. And part of the development of how we deal with this tension between erotic love on the one hand and procreation on the other is exactly what the story is about. Let's read again and think deeply. So I'm going to read from Rav Edi said, "It happened once that a woman in Sidon had lived 10 years with her husband without bearing him a child." And of course that wording is indicative of the assumption that it's her issue that there are no children. "They came to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and requested to be divorced from one another." So what does it mean? I don't have any more sources. You have to look on. Look on with Carol Ann, perhaps. Is there a chair there? No, there's no chair there. Look on at the end, perhaps, with Myra. So they came to Rabbi Shimon Yochai and requested to be divorced from one another. So let's just think, what are they asking? They seem to know the halakha that after 10 years, no children get divorced. So it's a pretty straightforward thing. So they tell him the story, and they say, we have to get divorced. If the story says that they came to get divorced, it means them together. It's not just the man. It's the man's mitzvah to procreate. But she also wants to get divorced. But why does she want to get divorced?
Because she's not giving him a child guilt.
Okay, so if she loves him, she wants the best for him. And he wants a child. Halachically, he's supposed to have children. So because of her love for him, she wants the best for him. And therefore, she's willing and interested in advocating for the divorce. But on the other hand, that's internally contradictory. Because if she loves him, why does she doesn't want to get divorced. So clearly, there's a tension here. Within her own psyche, she wants to get divorced and she doesn't want to get divorced. Now, as far as the man, we don't know. He wants to get divorced. Does he also not want to get divorced? Does he love her? We don't know. It doesn't say. So we read on. He said to them, I adjure you, just as you got married with feasting and drinking, so you shall separate with feasting and drinking. And we ask ourselves, so what is going on? What is his motivation? The law is that they're supposed to get divorced. So we should say to them, here, I'll write a get and you'll get divorced. What's this story of, I adjure you, just as you got married with feasting and drinking, so you shall separate with feasting and drinking. What does he have in mind?
Maybe they'll reconsider.
More sex and it might work.
That's look right, it's one of the two. It's one of the two. Either more sex and it might work. Might work, I guess you mean they might have a child.
Right.
Or he is hinting to them that although the halakha says get divorced, maybe I don't want you to get divorced. There's a deep, deep tension here. Now, let me just add, I put in parentheses the Hebrew word that the rabbi used for just as you got married. Nizdavagtem. Which literally means just as you copulated. He uses a word rich with sexual connotations. And it really looks like he's trying to say, just like you had your wedding night 10 years ago, have that wedding night again and get pretty drunk at it. And he's saying that. Well, does he think that one more sexual encounter to have a child, that's less likely? He seems to be hinting that he wants them to rekindle and reconnect to their erotic love connection so they won't get divorced. Of course, he can't say that to them directly because they came to him with a pious request to get married. I'm sorry, to get divorced. He's the rabbi that knows the law that says get divorced. But he's hinting to them that there's a kind of, let's say, a meta halakha behind the halakha that says get divorced. There's an idea that there's something problematic about breaking a marriage connection for this reason, and he wants them to feel again the love that keeps them together. That's pretty fascinating, I think.
Mm-hmm. Rabbi, there was a case that a friend of mine was involved in Israel a few years ago, where a woman had one or two young children, but she was in an accident, or she had polio. Anyway, she was totally paralyzed. Mm-hmm. Her husband, being Orthodox, was being forced by his rabbi, who would come to the hospital, demand that he divorces. He refused his rabbi, and everyone in the hospital heard him.
Definitely.
It was that strong. He said, I love her. She's been my wife. She's given me one or two children. But in his particular sect, apparently, the rabbi was forcing him as much as he could to divorce the woman because she couldn't provide more children, mm-hmm. Not one,
right.
More.
Right, so what's at stake in the story that we just heard from Stephanie, as well as this story, what's at stake is, what is the centerpiece of marriage? Mm-hmm. Is marriage about procreation, or is marriage about erotic companionship? Now, of course, it could be both. Certainly it could be both. But once you say both, you have to say, okay, both, but is one of them stronger than the other? And the story is struggling with the question of which of the two aspects of marriage is essential, which of course has to do with our understanding of what a woman is, what her place is, what man and woman's relationship is. So let's go on. They took his advice and kept holiday and made a great feast, and she got him too drunk. So the words are very clear. She got him too drunk.
Isn't that Solomon and Sheba?
I don't
remember. The same story when she got him so drunk and he gave her Manassas, a baby, and she sailed back to Ethiopia.
Okay, you know more than I do about this. So, look what it says. She got him too drunk. When his sensibilities returned to him, etc. There's a narrative illogic here. Okay, she got him too drunk. Well, and then what? But then it says his sensibility returned, as if the drunkenness didn't have any effect on the story. Right. He got drunk, he got sober, let's go on. No, something's wrong here. So what is it trying to tell us? She got him too drunk. When his sensibilities returned to him, etc. Apparently, what happened is exactly what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai wanted to happen. She got him too drunk, and they had a sexual encounter that night when he was too drunk. And when his sensibilities returned, he said to her, "My daughter, pick out," etc. In other words, his passion was aroused, and his sense of the connection to her was aroused. It didn't go to the point which he said, "I changed my mind about the divorce." But he felt his passionate love, and he expressed it by saying, "You're so wonderful to me, take anything in the house that you want."
What is Jewish law about a couple divorcing and then having sexual relationships afterwards?
If they're not married,
mm-hmm.
It's not allowed.
What happens if you get divorced and the wife is pregnant
mm-hmm.
and doesn't know
is
it?
Is that a mom's? I mean, what
No. So there's no problem there.
But then they allowed to remarry?
You know, if they want to remarry, you're allowed to remarry after you've got divorced. Except if there was a different husband in the middle. But a divorced couple can get remarried. In this case, they didn't get divorced.
Right.
In any formal sense. Right. So anyway, it looks like she gets him drunk. She seduces him. Which, of course, now brings us back to the beginning of the story. So was she really interested in divorce or not? Apparently, she wasn't that interested in divorce. She really wanted to remain married. But she had another part of her that was saying that for the sake of my husband's fulfillment of the mitzvah of having children, I'll agree to the divorce. But the rabbi has actually encouraged her to give expression to her opposition to the divorce and her desire to stay married, which she does by getting him too drunk. And then what happens, happens. When his sensibility returned to him, he said to her, "My daughter, pick out any article you want in the house and take it with you to your father's house." And that's again expression of his admiration and his love for her. Now, we wonder, when he said what he said, could it be perhaps that he hoped that she would do what she did?
Yeah, probably thought she'd take the candlesticks. Now the father...
I'm not sure. Certainly, what she ends up doing was in the direction that the rabbi had in mind. But was it also in the direction that the husband himself had in mind when he said, "Take everything or anything"? We don't know. So what did she do? When he was asleep, she gave an order to her servants and handmaids to lift him up on the bed and take and carry him to her father's house. At midnight, he awoke from his sleep. And when the effects of the wine passed from him, he said, "My daughter, where am I?" She replied, "You're in my father's house." "What am I doing in my father's house?" He said, "Did you not say to me last night, take any article you like from my house and go to your father's house? There's nothing in the world I care for more than you." What did he say back to her when she said, "There's nothing in the world I care for more than you"? He could have said, "That's nice, but we have to get divorced." That's the halakha. He could have said, "I really love you, but have to get divorced." Apparently, that's not what he said. He apparently agreed. Apparently, the love was rekindled between them. And they went back to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai And what did they say? Apparently he said we can't get divorced. And what did he say? He didn't say, well, there's nothing I can do. I have to get divorced. He prayed for them and they were remembered.
Remembered meaning a child?
A child was born. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that he prayed for them and a child was born in his office. It took a while. All the while that it took, they were together, even though 10 years had passed. In other words, the story in the end gives at least tacit approval to staying married after 10 years, even though the halakha says you have to get divorced. Why stay married?
Does it say you have to get divorced or you can?
Well, that's exactly the question that we're debating. The wording of the halakha was he's not at liberty to neglect his duty, which means you have to get divorced and find another way to fulfill his duty. But the halakha, the story, what we find here is something that's found more than once or two or three times or four times in the Talmud. That the Agadah that is embedded in a halachic passage serves to undermine the halakha itself. If the halakha, written in legal language, gives one approach, and then a story comes, an Agadah, that's very often represents a certain counter to the halakha, a certain subversive, if you will, element that's showing that there's another way possibly to look at it. The halakha emphasizes marriage for procreation. The Agadah emphasizes marriage for companionship and erotic love. And the story is working with that tension. In the end, of course, the story finds a miracle that's able to reconcile the two. You can have your cake and eat it too. He prayed for them. She got pregnant. Beautiful. You can have marriage for procreation and marriage for love. But of course, to emphasize what I started saying 5 minutes ago, he prayed for them, but that doesn't mean the baby was born in his office. They went home and they stayed married. So there's a sanctioning here of staying married even if no children are born. In this particular case, beautiful, everything worked out well. You have this and you have that. But ultimately, we're being told here that there's a foundation for understanding that the essence of marriage goes beyond procreation. It's a pretty fascinating story.
Where does adoption fit in Jewish law?
To make a long story short, adoption is a beautiful thing to help a child who doesn't have parents and to help parents that don't have children, but it's not a fulfillment of the biblical mitzvah of pru uvu, of be fruitful and multiply.
If the main thing in marriage is the relationship between the two people and not having a child, what about same-sex marriages? Are they possible according to this viewpoint?
Good question. Well, look, to make a very long story short, we know that the book of Leviticus says that there shouldn't be a relationship between a man and a man. And the rabbis extended that there shouldn't be relationships between a woman and a woman. Obviously, there's no procreation involved in homosexual relations. The type of erotic love and companionship that this particular story is emphasizing is that between a man and a woman. Mm-hmm. It's not within the world, within the purview of a relationship between a man and a man. Obviously, we all know that homosexual is a hot topic today in politics and in religion.
It helps overpopulation.
Okay. So, before we go on to the next story, anyone want to say anything, something about this one?
Wait a second. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
It's just something silly. Why, and maybe it's from the translation, why he calls her daughter?
In the literature of the Talmud, we find that men call their wives either Beiti or Biti. Beiti means my house, and Biti means my daughter. It's a... just think it's a language of affection.
Well, in Israel, when I can't find Jim, I have to say, Echo Baali. I'm calling him my God. Where's my husband?
No, you're calling him husband. It's the same thing in English. A husband is someone who shepherds.
But you said Baali, which is master. An idol.
No. That was the name of one of the gods. So, Jim, you wanted to say something?
Oh, it's interesting. You know, you look at this commentary about how we changed in modern day society where the idea of marriage is for companionship and love, and the idea of provocation of having children is secondary to a large degree. But in the U.S., in the Reform and Conservative movement, as opposed to the Orthodox, and that we have not even bothered to replace those who have died in the Holocaust, because it's I can look upon the demographics of the Ashkenazi Jews. You go back to 1,000 years, the basis of Ashkenazi Jews is only a 50,000 Jews at that time, and only because of the...
We did a good job of procreating.
We're not doing that now.
Right.
So, and no rabbi teaches the fact, except in the Orthodox, and we know by the demographics both in this country and in Israel, that in years to 75 years, the Orthodox will be a majority. And because of the lack of children in the Reform American Jews and in a marriage, the Reform will be a very, very small minority. So why don't they teach? Why do we not in present day? You never hear a sermon by a rabbi saying it's your job to get married and have 5 or 6 children and replace those.
We can't afford college.
I'm not a Reform conservative rabbi. I can't answer that. But clearly, most of American Jewry.
If he said that.
Okay, right. Most of American Jewry and Reform and conservative movements reflect the mores of the society we live in. And as you said, the society we live in.
The society is basically the instant gratification of yourself. Instead of a wife having children, her object is to go out and have a career. And she may or may not have children.
These are big, big subjects, right?
Yeah.
That.
But you know, this is based on this is what we say here.
You're right.
On the other hand, I'm thinking we put 5 kids through 23 years of college. We're helping 3 grandchildren this coming year to college tuition. If you had a lot more children, we couldn't afford it.
Well, one solution is to make Aliyah. An Israel college course, one-tenth of what it costs here.
That's only if you can get your whole family to come with you.
Okay.
Our daughter.
Yeah, so indeed, everyone's right that this story can serve as the basis for a discussion of many, many issues that are on the agenda, the top of the agenda today. Let's go to another story.
But it is interesting in present-day Judaism, the object is to your self-gratification rather than...
You're right.
Maybe they're leaving it to the Jewish mothers to tell their kids to go out and procreate.
No, we're not telling our daughters.
Okay.
Well, once they get married, they'll get married and have children. That's what we say to our kids. That's our Jewish mother.
Well, doesn't say
I have to say it louder. Okay, so the next story is from the Midrash Tanhuma, a rabbinic set of Midrash. On Parshat Pikudei, right, one of the parshiot from the book of Exodus. And the verse we're focusing on is the following verse. These are the records of the tabernacle. Eile Pikudei Mishkan, which seems to be a very, very bland verse. You find that when Israel were in harsh labor in Egypt, Paro decreed against them that they should not sleep at home nor have relations with their wives.
So we drain their energy.
Rabbi Shimon bar Halafta said, what did the daughters of Israel do? They would go down to draw water from the Nile, and the Holy One would prepare for them little fish in their buckets, and they would sell some and cook some, so that they could buy wine, and go to the field and feed their husbands, as it is said. They embittered their lives with hard work in making mortar and bricks and all the labor in the field. When they had eaten and drunk, the women would take the mirrors and look into them with their husbands, and she would say, I am more beautiful than you. And he would say, no, I am more beautiful than you. As a result, they would arouse in themselves desire, and they were fruitful and multiplied, and God visited them with fertility immediately. Some of our sages said they bore 2 children at a time. Others say they bore 6 at a time. Yet others say they bore 12 at a time. And so others say 600,000 at each time.
Because of the mirrors?
all because of the mirrors. And all these numbers from the mirrors. In the merit of those mirrors, which they showed their husbands to accustom themselves to desire, from the midst of the harsh labor, they raised up all the hosts. As it is said, all the hosts of God went out of the land of Egypt. And it said, God brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt in their hosts. When God told Moses to make the tabernacle, the whole people stood up and offered whatever they had. Silver, gold, copper, precious stones, everyone eagerly offered everything. The women said, what have we to offer as a gift to the tabernacle? So they stood and brought the mirrors and went to Moshe. When Moses saw those mirrors, he was furious with them. He said to Israel, take sticks and break their thighs. What do they need mirrors for? Then God said to Moses, Moses, these you despise? These mirrors raised up all the hosts in Egypt. Take them and make of them a bronze laver and a bronze stand. As it is said, he made the bronze laver from the mirrors of the women who flocked to the entrance of the tent of meeting. There are many layers of interpretation and meaning in the story. So let's go back through the story. So background. We all know from the beginning of the book of Exodus that Paro is greatly distressed by the multiplication of the Jewish people. And he tries to do something about it. Right? Remember the different things he does. One thing he does is he says that the midwives have to take the male children and kill them. It doesn't work. Right? Later he says, throw the firstborn of the males into the Nile. And that doesn't work either. They continue to propagate. And of course, he enslaves them. So we can easily understand that one, at least, of the purposes of the Egyptian slavery from the point of view of Paro was not economic. It was not economic. It was demographic. The slavery was an effort to try and prevent the increase of these people who might, he's afraid, take over the country. With that background, this midrash is constructed. The idea that the main focus of Paro was to try to discourage the reproduction of more Jewish boys and more Jewish girls.
But then at the same time, he's also decreasing the number of slaves.
And that's okay, because his main object is not to have slaves. His main object is to have less Jews. Right? That's what it seems from the beginning of the book of Exodus.
The whole world.
The slavery is only a means to prevent procreation. Because the idea is that if they work so hard, they'll have no energy left for procreation. The Midrash adds to that and says in the first two lines that we read that you find that when Israel were in harsh labor in Egypt, Paro decreed against them that they should not sleep at home nor have relations with their wives. That Midrashic addition to what the book of Exodus says makes perfect sense. Because really, as we just said, the purpose of the decrees against the Jews is to prevent them from overcoming the country with inundating the country with more and more foreigners, more and more Israelites. So the verse that's about to be quoted in the next paragraph says that he gave them all different manner of labor in the fields. From the word fields, the Midrash understands he sent them into the field to be away from their wives. That was the purpose of it. But what happened, according to the Midrash, the wives went to the fields. Let's read it again. Rabbi Shimon bar Halafta said, what did the daughters of Israel do? They would go. So in other words, according to this, the men accepted the decree, did their work, and if it was up to the men, there'd be no second generation of Jewish children. But the women wouldn't accept the decree. They revolted. Remind us of Yehudit from last week. Judith, who wouldn't accept the situation that caused Jews not to get married. So here, the women wouldn't accept the situation. There's not going to be any more Jewish children born. So they found a way to circumvent Paro's decree. They would go down to draw water from the Nile, and the Holy One would prepare for them little fish in their buckets. Now, fish, we know, are a symbol of fertility and procreation. So God helps those who help themselves. The women want to find a way to get to their husbands in the field and encourage procreation, so God helps them. They would sell some and cook some so they could buy wine. Well, what's the purpose of the wine?
Intoxication.
Right? The wine is to seduce, to intoxicate. It's part of a plan, a feminine diabolical plan to seduce their husbands who are too tired and too far away to think about anything but going to sleep to get up the next day for work. And go to the field where the women weren't supposed to be, right? The women are encroaching, as it were, on the male domain. Go to the field and feed their husbands, and also it implies feed their husbands and give their husbands wine to drink. As it is said, they embittered their lives with hard work in making mortar and bricks and all labor in the field. So under these terrible circumstances of oppression and labor, and the men are dirty and grimy in the field, the women come and try to seduce their husbands, not for the purpose of erotic love, but for the purpose of procreation, right? The women are thinking of the next generation of Jewish children. So they strengthen their husbands in the field physically with food. They get them drunk. And then what does it say? When they'd eaten and drunk, the women would take the mirrors, which we never heard of before. They take the mirrors and look into them with their husbands, and she would say, "I am more beautiful than you." Of course, this is a drunken game that's going on. And he would say, "No, I'm more beautiful than you." So what's going on? They're playing games in the field. Like, it's incongruous. Just think of this. The Midrash is saying that every single woman went out to her husband in the field with her fish and with her wine and with her mirror, and they're all playing erotic games in the field for the purpose of saving the next generation of the Jewish people. They don't teach this in Hebrew school, do they? What would happen if they did? Okay. Now, I had an interesting thought. So, they're playing games, and they're looking at themselves in the mirrors. In the mirror, you see more Israelites than presently exist. Right? There's the two of them, but now there's four of them. So it's actually a symbolic precursor to procreation. In addition to the fact that in a very literal sense, it's about arousal and sexual desire, it's about foreplay, but it's also about a foreshadowing. There's going to be more and more Jews. You see them already in the mirror. They're procreating before your very eyes. And that's what it says. As a result, they would arouse in themselves desire. They were fruitful and multiplied, and God visited them with fertility immediately. So again, God gets involved. First, he brought the fish, and now he is visiting them immediately with fertility. Now, that word visited them, I put it in parentheses, in brackets, in the Hebrew, pakad. God visited them. That word pakad, which means to visit, also means to record. It's the same word that was used in the verse that this Midrash is playing on. The verse was, these are the pikudei HaMishkan, the recordings.
Is that the same word that's used about Sarah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like we read in Rosh Hashanah about Hashem pakad et Sarah. God visited Sarah with a child after Abraham, after many, many decades of infertility. So when the Midrash says that God pakad visited them, first of all, it's going back to the verse. These are the pikudim of the Mishkan, which means these are the records, and it goes on to record how much silver and how much gold, etc. But it's playing with that word and saying it really means these are the visitations of the Mishkan, these are the giving birth of the Mishkan. What does that mean? We'll get back to that later. And it reminds us, of course, of Sarah. It reminds us of all the matriarchs who were barren for so many years, and God visited them with children, as it were.
So it goes back to Abraham. It
goes back to Abraham.
So the thing I'm curious about is, well, I mean, first of all, the mirror doesn't make any sense. You had to be so wealthy to afford a bronze mirror. But
they all had bronze mirrors. That's what the Midrash says.
It's a Bubba Misa.
Fine, let it be a Bubba Misa. Remember, please, we're not learning history.
Right.
We're learning about ideas.
The Bronze Age.
Right. So I want to say two more things. By using the same word, visitation, become pregnant, the same word that's used in the verse, that these are the recordings, the pikudim of the Mishkan, we're connecting this pregnancy to holiness, to the Mishkan. symbolically. And secondly, I just want to say that the very, very end of the book of Genesis, when Joseph dies...
You remember the people. Yeah.
Joseph, so let's read
you
that verse.
You take notice of the people.
Right. The very end of the book of Genesis, Joseph is on his deathbed, and he says, God will redeem you after my death, redeem you from Egypt. And the word he used is... Pakod Yifkod Elokim Etchem. God will certainly visit you,
okay,
remember you,
if we
redeem
were
you.
To say to visit, it would be Pakod or
Lekpod. Pakod Yifkod, it's a future imperative. God will certainly.
He will certainly.
So I'm on page 84 in the English only. It's chapter 50, verse 24. At length, Joseph said to his brothers, I'm about to die. God will surely take notice of you. Pakod Yifkod, God will visit, and bring you up from this land to the land that I am promised on oath. In other words, this Midrash is saying that the act, the courageous act of the women to try and circumvent the decree of Paro and to get to their husbands and procreate, this is what's causing the visitation, the redemption of the Jewish people from Egypt. Because if there was no Jews in the next generation, there'd be no one to redeem.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So it takes women to give God a little more.
Yep. We go on in the story. Some of our sages say they bore two children at a time. Others say they bore six at a time. Yet others say they bore 12 at a time. So others say 600,000. Now, just think of what that means. 600,000 is the number of Israelites that left Egypt. By saying, and of course don't take it literally, that every woman gave birth to 600,000 Israelites, it means that the fate of the whole Jewish people rests upon each individual woman.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's very powerful, I think. Okay.
It would have been really painful also.
There wouldn't be enough seconds in your life to have 600,000 children at once. But figuratively, every woman gave birth to 600,000 people, children, Israelites.
That makes us matriarchs.
Mm-hmm. In the merit of those mirrors, I'm sorry, in all of these numbers from the mirrors, the mirrors symbolize, what do they symbolize, the mirrors, do you think?
Sexuality.
Sexuality, mm-hmm. Obviously. The mirrors indicate erotic sexuality. And the merit of those mirrors, which they showed their husbands to accustom themselves to desire, from the midst of the harsh labor, they raised up all the hosts. In other words, the arousal of sexual desire is the most holiest thing. It's what established the future of the Jewish people. It's what saved us from the gzeirah, from the decree of Paro. And it brings the verse, all the hosts of God went out of the land of Egypt. Who created these hosts? The mirrors. But the mirrors symbolize. God brought the children of Israel out of the land of Egypt in their hosts, in their great number. Hosts means great number. But later we'll see there's a play on words with that word also. Okay. I have one more thing that I wanted to say. I said a few minutes ago that the mirrors already foreshadow the future, that there'll be more Jews, because you see. But also, mirrors, especially copper mirrors, tend to show you a reality that's really not there. It's a little bit distorted, right? A mirror creates reality, creates a different reality. And therefore, mirror symbolizes that things can be different than they are today. Mirrors symbolize hope in that sense. So these mirrors they brought, and the sexuality engendered by them, they say, we're now enslaved. We're now grimy and dirty and oppressed. But the future could be different. And who carries the mirrors to the field? It's the women. What we're trying to say is that the men are living in the present, the women are living in the future. The women bring hope to the Jewish people, and it's only in the foundation of that hope that the next generation is born. Anyone who heard Jonathan Sacks speak 2 weeks ago, he talked about hope. No one was there. Someone was there, right? Hope is not optimism. In place, he said, optimism, the way he said it as follows. He said, optimism is a blind belief that the future will be different. Hope means I'm going to do something to make the future different. That was what he said. So basing myself upon that, the mirror symbolizes hope that is brought down to brass tacks by these women who are willing to fight against present reality and trying to make it something different, to break out of the oppressive cycle of the present and live with the real hope for the future. Okay.
That means
next paragraph, yeah.
That women, instead of saying they want to go to med school or law school, should say they want to have six children.
Or both.
So, Jim, that to me is an important point. But it's not in the Midrash, right? We live in a more complicated world than the Midrash does, in which we know that women have the capacity for more than the two things mentioned in these Midrashim. These Midrashim see women as part of marriage, part of the erotic love of marriage, and number two, women as vehicles of procreation. Today we know that women also have heads on their shoulders. That complicates the picture and creates the dynamic and the tension between career and tikkun olam on the one hand and procreation on the other. But that's a whole different can of worms. That's not here. It's an important can of worms. But it's not here in the Midrash as far as I can see.
I have a question. In the beginning, this almost gives the connotation that it was the men who were doing the hard labor and the women were just
it does.
At home.
Hopping out the kids.
or not. I mean, in
right.
this case. I mean, is this fairly truthful, or were the women not doing the hard labor as well as the men?
Had to do the cleaning, the
cooking?
The
Torah, is there any indication of this one way or the other?
Well, there was probably other work to be done than in the fields. You know,
the
they
house,
had to keep the house.
The cooking, I mean, they didn't have a refrigerator.
Yeah, I don't know if in the Torah there are any indications one way or the other. As we know, the Torah, like any other document of the period, focuses on the men.
Yes.
It only mentions the women in isolated circumstances. Don't know.
It'd be nice if we had a class where we rewrote it. Just to see how it would come out.
The truth is that there are such things today.
That's what I mean.
You can do your own midrash.
Okay, let's go on. We have six or seven more minutes. When God told Moses to make the tabernacle, right, this is a year after leaving Egypt, they're in the desert, the whole people stood up and offered whatever they had, silver, gold, copper, precious stones, everyone eagerly offered everything. The women said, what have we to offer as a gift to the tabernacle? So they stood and brought the mirrors and went to Moshe. So they brought their mirrors to Moshe. When Moses saw the mirrors, he was furious with them. He said to Israel, take sticks and break their thighs. What do they need mirrors for? So first of all, a thigh is a euphemism. Thigh is about sexuality. Break their thighs is basically saying protest against their bringing sexuality into the tabernacle. The tabernacle, wait a second, is about God. It's about the Spirit. It's about love of the supernatural. And you're bringing those mirrors which symbolize sexuality and the physical because of the story we just read. So Moses sees a dichotomy between the physical and the spiritual. You can't have the two together. It's either one or the other. The world of the physical is the mundane. The world of the spiritual is God's world. But then God said to Moses, Moses, these you despise? These mirrors raised up all those hosts in Egypt. In other words, God says to Moses, you got it wrong. You can't separate between the corporal, the physical, the sexual, and the spiritual. It's one thing. These mirrors, which are all about sexuality, are actually all about the most spiritual thing in the world. They created the salvation. Without these mirrors, there would be no redemption from Egypt. It's all about the mirrors. Moses, you got it all wrong. So God says, take them and make of them a bronze laver and a bronze stand for the priests to sanctify themselves. In other words, at the center of the Mishkan is the sink that this priests wash the hands in, they can't do their worship in the sanctuary without washing their hands, that sink is made from the bronze of the mirrors, saying that sexuality is actually the gateway to the spirituality of the tabernacle. You can't have one without the other. You can't have the spirituality of the sanctuary without those mirrors. Because sexuality, we're being told by this midrash, the sexuality specifically of the women who arouse their husbands, that is at the centerpiece of the spirituality of the Jewish people. And then it quotes the verse, he made the bronze laver from the mirrors of the women who flocked to the entrance of the tabernacle. That's a verse in the Torah. It says that the laver was made from the mirrors, and it's the women who flocked. The word flock is, it's sovot, the same root as the word sava, which means the hosts. We've been talking about the mirrors creating the hosts, so all the connections are being made here. The women flocked with their mirrors, and that flocking to the tabernacle is related to the fact that all these hosts have been created by these mirrors. As we end, I want to show you a passage from the Talmud that I brought here in number 13 of my notes that I gave out to you as well with the story. You see the 13 there? So it says, not only the Jewish people, but also the tabernacle is founded upon this holy sexuality. These mirrors are for the lavers that allowed entrance into the tabernacle. See Babylon and Talmud tractate Yoma, page 54a, which says, when Israel makes pilgrimage on the three festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, the curtains of the ark are rolled back, and they are shown the cherubim, the kruvim, hugging, intertwined one in the other. They are told, look at how beloved you are before the Holy One, like the love of male for female. So the story goes like this. In the Holy of Holies, in the tabernacle, and in the temple in Jerusalem, in the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctum, which is far inside, you have the ark with the cherubim on top. And the description in the Torah says the cherubim are these human-like figures with wings, and the wings are touching each other up above, the one with the other. Now, no one ever sees this, because no human being is allowed in the Holy of Holies except the high priest on Yom Kippur when he goes in there with the incense smoke, so even he can't see anything. That's what the Torah says. But the Midrash says that the curtains that shield the Holy of Holies from the holy were opened, and then the doors shielding the courtyard from the holy, right, there's a sanctum inside of a sanctum, were opened, so that from the outside you can see into the Holy of Holies. When was this done? On the festivals, Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot. And when they rolled the curtains away, they didn't see two human-like cherub figures looking at each other with their wings. These figures miraculously embraced. And the whole Jewish people could see that. And the metaphor is that they are, these two figures, like a male and a female, embracing, representing God and the Jewish people, embracing, as we do on the holidays, the Jewish people come to God and embrace God, as it were. So the model for the divine human relationship is the male-female relationship.
I do have a question. When it comes back to the thighs, we have Jacob wrestling with an angel, and thigh was broken.
Right.
So apparently a thigh is a little more important than what you eat on a chicken.
That's a good point. I never thought of that. I never thought of that. The commentators say...
You're not as old as I am.
That's right. The commentators say that when Abraham told his servant Eliezer to put your hand under my thigh and swear, what it really means is to take hold of my sexual organ. That, I know it sounds to us very gross, I understand. Right. But it's, that's what it means to swear. That's how you swear.
But also the organs are what give children.
That's exactly the point.
So, yeah,
that's exactly
so
the point.
It goes back to
so here
point.
When it says, Moses says, break their thighs, it means break their organ of sexuality. It means I'm protesting against bringing sexuality into the tabernacle. But God's response is, no, bring sexuality into the tabernacle. It's one thing. Sexuality is part of the tabernacle, just like we saw now with the Kruvim in Tractate Yoma, that sexuality is part of the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle.
So why then in Orthodox synagogues can't men and women sit together?
That's really another subject. Let's just end with one thing you might not have known. Let's make this practical. There's a source I brought here that we're not reading that says that the charoset at the Passover Seder represents the apple tree under which the men and women made love in the fields.
Oh, wow.
It has this little bit of apple, sometimes in charoset. So one interpretation is that the one interpretation is the charoset symbolizes the mortar, right? The making bricks. The other interpretation says, you can see it in the sheets that I brought, it represents the apple tree under which they made love, as it says in the book of Song of Songs, Tachat hatapuach oroticha, under the apple tree I aroused you. So when you have your Seder this coming year, keep that in mind. Say it again.
You have to be careful with wine, though. Number one, fall asleep. Number two, you can't perform.
Okay, but according to the Midrash, the wine actually was a prelude to sexuality. And that's why there's wine in the charoset, according to this interpretation.
It's sort of like people who have oysters on the head.
The discussion right now about all of the sexuality is kind of interesting, because just in the last class, we had one quick sentence about maybe it was the worship of Baal. Mm-hmm. And
I didn't say it, she said it.
Oh, yeah. And having to perform sexual acts instead of sacrifice, or
as part of
the worship.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if part of this is a little bit of a throwback.
I see.
To
I see.
Also, why does an apple tree have to do? If they had an apple tree, they have an apple leaf. Why? It must have been a fig tree. You use a fig leaf.
So it's true that there are there is some evidence that that the cult of sacred prostitution was part of some ancient idolatrous rites. We're talking about something that, of course, is not about actual sexuality within the tabernacle, but it does become.
Isn't it in the Torah somewhere?
I have nothing to say.
Isn't it in the Torah somewhere that there were women outside of a temple, and we also had a little. Every now and then, you read a little something about
Tamar
sitting by the side of the road.
Well, it doesn't say in the Tanakh, but in the book of Shmuel, there's discussion of the improprieties of the sons of Eli, and it doesn't say what you said, but there's Midrash that says that they indeed ask sexual favors from the women who came to bring their sacrifices.
Right.
That's not in the scripture.
I don't
think so.
I just remember reading it, but yeah.
Yeah. So, Myra.
And for those of you who don't want to wait for Passover, another side story, if you go to Whole Foods, they have potato latkes and brisket. And charoset.
I saw that.
For some reason, they think charoset must be.
I read about that.
So you want to have fun to Whole Foods right now, you can have your little wine.
Really?
They had some kind of big thing.
Hate me, but.